Welcome, welcome, welcome. We are doing a recording for season 2, episode 5 of The Corporate Critic. I am your host, Reese Roberts, and we're here with Seneca Smith, which is our journalist here. He's going to be doing some wonderful facilitation of a wonderful discussion today. We will be talking about the introduction to the administration of money, where we're essentially just going to have a very naturally flowing conversation about money and how the law is designed to administer the flow of commerce and how it's meant to regulate the flow of commerce for natural persons, which are consumers, and also for artificial persons as our corporate entities and things of that nature. So we have some general guidelines that we're going to be following to try to hit some very important points about money and about the administration of it as far as the law is concerned and about, you know, how the regulations are to govern. So without further ado, we're going to start off just by introducing the concepts of what credit is. If I'm not mistaken, our first kind of kickoff is going to be about what is credit and what a debt agreement is. So let's see. Did you have any particular questions that you wanted to ask about how money is created or what credit actually is, where the agreements are actually putting us, you know, as far as our position is concerned?
No. I will say though that if you see me kind of moving forward like that right there, it's because I got this back massager on my chair that moves me forward. And so magnificent. Now, I don't want you thinking I'm over here having like some type of conversation. You said we're spiritually less. I don't, you know what I mean? It's just this massage on my chair. And, yes. So,
you'll be living, you know, life. Yeah, at this,
like this second, no, because, you know, it's funny. We talk about cash rule and everything around us. Yet. Seems like credit is the actual, is what really rules everything around us. So I wanted you to just get deeper into that before I kind of just start hitting you with all the questions.
Okay, cool. So one of the key points that we wanted to go over, which I particularly want to go over, is about the spiritual sort of esoteric origins of law and administration. So administrative law is a natural form of law. Okay, so it derives from universal laws, things that we understand to be esoteric in nature. These are things that our ancestors used to honor when they would, you know, sort of lay out venerations and things like that for deities, you know, honoring the wind, honoring the water, things of those of that nature. So for the administrative kind of law, what it basically says is that there is a process. In the Constitution, they call it due process, where administration needs to occur a certain way in order for law to be administered fairly. Okay. And in law, we call that equity. Okay. So what happens is there.
Which, you don't mind, I'm sorry. Can I interject go ahead. At this point? Because
yes, absolutely.
In my experience, individuals have taken the words equity and equitable, or equitable and equality to mean the same thing when they don't. Mm-hmm. Could you take a second to kind of explain, especially in accordance with the law, what that means, equitable versus equal?
Oh, absolutely. So something that is equitable is something that means you're receiving the value of something at an agreeable and fair rate, so to speak. So equal means that this is two equal parts having the same value, the same weight, the same measure. But equitable simply means that if you did 10% of the work, then you get 10% of the benefit or 10% of the compensation, so to speak. Not to say that you're equal to everyone else. Okay, so in equity, what we're looking for is to make sure that if there is a value that is due to me, that I receive it fairly according to what I contributed or what role or position I played within that transaction. So in our legal system, our transactions are typically three-party transactions under trust. So in our economic space, everything happens under trust because we have something called a government, which is a requirement, or I should say a regulatory third party. Whereas in our financial transactions, we have a third party that's there to insert themselves into the process of administering money so that they can regulate it, so to speak. They call themselves regulating commerce. And so that's why we have the necessity of maintaining our equitable interest, because if we're not careful, trust law can be very inequitable, okay, depending on how your contracts are written. I want to make a distinction real quick, because a contract is a two-party minimum, okay? But a trust is a three-party minimum, okay? You have to have at least three parties to consider it a trust. A contract is a minimum of two. So for us, we typically would be contracting with each other in a normal trade or exchange, like the barter system that used to exist before we had settlers and all this commercial activity on land. We had just two-party contracts would be the standard. Okay, but then the standard became the three-party contract or the three-party agreement when we see the insertion or the imposing of a government that now requires itself to govern our two-party contract. So now it's standard of three. Right. Okay, so when we are talking about the due process of that three-party transaction, it completely changes the landscape of how money flows, about how it works, who's responsible for it, who is supposed to sort of secure the money. Now, it's very interesting the times we live in, which I think are very interesting times, because we are now seeing the dollar really take on a more secure form of digitization. So for it to be, money has been digital for a very long time. It already has been digitized, but the encryption of the digital asset, which is now the blockchain, has completely altered what we know as the three-party transaction. Because like I said earlier, the three-party transaction was to regulate the debt agreements or promissory notes, orders to pay between two different parties. Okay, we're kind of going back to the two-party agreement instead of having to require regulation, because encryption is all the regulation you need in any transaction. So the government cannot necessarily impose itself anymore whenever people are using blockchain. And that's the reason why they don't want us using blockchain, because it eliminates their role in commerce. The entire thing, it's almost like Uber eliminating the role of a taxi cab. Or Airbnb eliminating the role of a hotel almost. Now, you know, they regulating that, but you know, the concept remains. So we're seeing a very interesting time where things are very volatile and unstable right now, because our economic controls are being very much uprooted by technology. And so what credit is, now let's go to that, what our topic is all about. So credit is happening in a new way now, because credit is generated by way of agreements.
I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
To interject, because the definition of credit as defined by the law is to me important. There's a key word in there. You spoke on it earlier. So would you mind just speaking on what is credit? What does that actually mean in real time? You can use the definition that.
Mm-hmm. So credit under the law has different definitions depending on the context, but the ones I'm going to highlight right now are just more relevant. So I would say, firstly, a very important definition in context is credit is the lawful money is what they call it under the law. Credit is what they consider to be lawful money. Now, number two, credit is the ability to pay for something later. Okay, it's the ability to not have to use a fiat form of currency to pay for something using a paper fiat currency. You're actually saying, I'm going to pay for this on credit, which I can pay it now or later. It's kind of like a store credit.
Right.
Okay. And that's actually what I call our credit system. It's a store credit because nations around the world have their own store brand of currency. So in India, their store credits are called rupees. Okay. In China, their store credits are called yen. Okay. And wherever you have in Mexico, they call them pesos. We call them dollars. So our currencies are just store credits for the nation that the landmass that we're on. So when we talk about U.S. store credits, the dollar is really just an ability for us to pay something that is due later. It's kind of like the reason why the nation operates in a deficit.
Right. Right. And that's important to understand.
Mm-hmm. It's just a deficit that exists. So when we're looking at administration of money, the first thing that is important to understand is that money comes, well, I should say credits come from debits. Okay. Credits come from debits. It's a natural balance. And that's the reason why I say there's a heavy esoteric implication, a heavy esoteric understanding of it in money administration, because in our world, okay, in our natural environment, our universal code is binary. It's all about a mirror image and balance of whatever is above is so below. Whatever is internal is also external. As so within is also without. So with those concepts, it's the same thing when you talk about a balancing of a ledger. So with the United States, there is a double ledger. Okay, we have the existence of a private ledger and then also a public ledger. So on both of these ledgers, you have different parties. You have people of the public, okay, and then you have people in the private. People of the public are considered to be the government. Anything public is public elections, public, you know, servants, members, people who hold public office, that's the public, the government. Then you have private citizens. Okay, that's consumers, natural people, natural persons. Now, it goes a little deeper because a natural person like you and I, we also have a natural double ledger, because whenever a natural person does business, okay, they also create a natural double ledger within themselves. So Charisse has a double ledger because Charisse is a natural person and also because Charisse is an artificial person. She has businesses that she has created. She uses artificial money to go back and forth between business to business. For if you and I were doing business, that would be commercial use of an entity. So it would be considered artificial, and it would be something that you and I have to balance between you and I. So that's on a micro level. On a macro level, hopefully you're able to follow. We have this double ledger where if I create a debt, okay, and this is going to be a little bit making reference to what a lot of people know as HJR 192 and also the 1933 switchover when we lost our currency and we were no longer backed by gold. We lost our real form of currency, which is we lost our gold and silver to back the dollar as a natural resource. So that is when we switched over to this credit system where the United States makes a commitment called full faith and credit, where they say any tax revenue that we generate from taxing our citizens or our internal, you know, pledges, then we will use that money to pay off the debts of the people, because we have taken the natural resources, which is the gold and silver, for people to redeem their credits. So today, we can't go to a bank and tell them I want gold instead of these green pieces of paper when I make a withdrawal. We can't do that. And because we can't do that, the United States said, instead of us giving you gold, we're going to give you credits for the gold instead. The gold and silver is no longer, we got rid of it, we lost it, so we're going to give you these credits. So nowadays, when we go and we're looking to do exchanges, okay, we only can use paperwork to evidence the exchanges that are happening between us. So when I create a debt, the law says I have to have an instrument to represent the fact that I have created that debt. What does the instrument look like? It looks like a contract. It looks like a check. You understand? Right. It looks like a check or a money order or something that says, I promise to pay you or I order you to pay. So in the language of administration, exactly, you pay to the order of. Exactly. That's on your checks. It's on your promissory notes. I promise to pay this amount to this person. So when you sign off on that, you have just created a store credit because you cannot go to any bank and ask them to give you real money for that amount that has been promised or pledged to you or the amount that you're ordering someone to pay. So in real life, the administration of money or the creation of credit comes from any time there is an indebtedness. If I have a debt, I have just now created a credit. Our problem in America is that we have not been taught how to go to the bank and redeem those credits by way of using our instruments to negotiate the exchange. Okay, so our exchanges are happening now, what they call in blank endorsement. So if I hand, it's just like, okay, a bearer instrument, like I said, a debt instrument, it represents money administration.
Yeah, give us an example.
I'm going to give you a good example. So if I go and I write out a check, this is a promise to pay or an order to pay, where it says I order my bank to draw money from this account, pay it to somebody because I owe this person some money. Somebody write them a check. So if I go in there and on the back of that check, I do not stipulate that I want this money to come from a particular account, the bank will actually take the value of that security because a check is a security instrument, and they will take the value of it and deposit it into their own reserves, their own accounts, instead of you reserving it to your own assets or your own ledger. So they call that a blank endorsement. It's something that we have not been taught to do, to especially when it comes to our Social Security accounts. The United States is obligated to pay these types of debts, but it's steadily coming out of our account because we are saying, I don't know anything. Essentially, the way we're executing the transaction is we don't know anything about the United States having this obligation to pay these debts on the credits. Okay. With the credits, rather.
Right.
So whenever the United States says, oh, yeah, that's our obligation, we'll pay for the debts because we don't have any more gold, we don't have any more silver. Now, come up to the bank and give me an instrument that orders me to do that properly. We don't know how to do that. We're acting as what they call a surety for the United States government. So a surety says that even though I have this credit generated on my books because you just came and gave me a debt instrument, you have not endorsed it properly. You have not given me proper instructions to take this from the United States and give it to the person that you owe. You're telling me to take it from your account and give it to the person that you owe. And this is the way we've been trained to operate in the United States. So a credit is being generated on two different ledgers. But well, I'll say this. Whenever I create my debt, I agree to pay somebody, I owe them, or I order the bank or whatever, there is a debt that I've just generated on my ledger, okay? Naturally, because of the correspondence of the duality, the credit for the United States is also generated at the same time, okay? Because it has to balance. Every entry on the ledger has to balance itself. So on my ledger, I have the debt. On the United States, they have a debt. Now, our goal in America is to learn how to initiate a liquidation of the credit that the United States has generated on their ledger so that it will come over to our ledger. The way we do that is we endorse our instruments to the United States as a debt because that's the only way it will actually disperse itself as a credit to us, if that makes any sense. Okay. So when I create a debt, they create a credit. Now, if I need that credit that they just generated, I got to give them my debt so that they'll give me the credit.
Right.
You see what it means? So that's essentially how we should be operating. But right now, we're not giving our debts to the United States. We're giving our debts to the bank, and the bank is taking the credit for themselves. Okay? We're just giving the debt to the bank. And the bank says, oh, you're giving me free money because your debt is your money. It's the redeeming that we're supposed to be doing that they're doing on our behalf. I'm going to pause right there so it'll sink in, okay? It's got to sink in.
Yeah, because I feel like I need to go to the bank to take all the money out.
Absolutely. And that's what they don't want you to do, because it's a Ponzi scheme. Have you ever seen the story of Bernie Madoff?
Absolutely.
The story of Bernie Madoff will tell you exactly why they do not want you to do that. Bernie Madoff was cussing people clean out because they was calling him saying, Bernie, I need my money back. And he was like, this is not a money market account. You don't take all this money out, because he knew that if all y'all take your money out of these accounts that I'm holding, we won't have anything to give anybody. It's just going to crash. And that's exactly what happened. That's what landed him in jail and caused him to die in jail. It's because the banks are doing the exact same thing. And I also want to point out that Bernie Madoff was a pivotal person in the creation of our securities market. I think they say he created the NASDAQ. If I'm not mistaken, he was one of the most pivotal people in the development of that system. Yes. So that's what credit actually does for us. And and Bernie Madoff was, to me, brilliant. Even though he was a nefarious character, he was still brilliant. I think it was a brilliant scheme. And it lasted for 40 years, I think they said. That thing lasted for a long amount of time. For it to be just a scheme. So I think it's really important for us to start understanding that
he did launch NASDAQ.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he launched NASDAQ. Mm-hmm. It's pivotal. And so and because he was so integral in the development of that system, he was hard to regulate because he had so much influence. They were honored to meet him. Instead, you know, you got SEC people running up through your door. They're like, is that Bernie Madoff? Yeah. They're like, oh my God, sir, it's so nice to meet you. You're supposed to be here regulating this man, and you just shaking his hand like you just met your idol. So it turns into a question about whether or not we understand the position that we're in as a population of consumers, because the more informed we come and the more equipped we come with technology, like I said, we're going to be eliminating the need for the dollar or for the government. I'm going to pull up a video that I'm going to play a clip real quick about what I'm talking about.
No, I say, okay, yep.
Oh, okay, so I'm gonna pull up this clip real quick. Give me just a second. I love to pull up this clip. It's one of my favorites. Okay. Now I'm going to share my screen. Let's see, how do I do this? Share my screen. And let's go here. Share. Now. All right, let's take a quick look at this.
Social and economic inequality is at the highest level it's been since the Great Depression. In October, this month, Spain's youth unemployment rate is at 45%, 8 years after the crisis. Now, there's no silver bullet to fix the many problems that ail society. But why not start with where it all began? We have an opportunity, arguably once in a generation opportunity, to reinvent financial services for a new era of trust and legitimacy. Now, the leaders of the industry today, many of the banks and others, have a choice to make. They can either do it themselves or have it done to them. Because we are entering a new era of technology. You've heard the expression, software is eating the world. Well, software is finally eating Wall Street. And the technology likely to have the greatest impact on the world of financial services for the next 20 years has arrived. But it's not big data, the cloud, robo-advisors, collaborative finance, or new entrants like Tencent and Apple Pay. It's actually the technology behind cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin, and it's called the blockchain. This technology will transform the industry, but it also represents nothing short of the second generation of the internet. So when you use the internet today to send and move and share information, you're not actually sending an original, you're sending a copy, and you're retaining an original. And generally speaking, that's okay. In fact, it's one of the great advantages of the internet is that we have this publishing platform that allows us to democratize information. Except when it comes to things that have value, like say money, sending a copy is a bad idea. If I give you $20 in payment for something, it's really important that you know you have it and I don't still have it. Because if I could send the same $20 to every single person in this room, the $20 becomes worthless. So it turns out it's great to have a printing press for information, but it's not so great to have a printing press for money. And this is a problem that cryptographers and technologists have been trying to resolve for years. How do you prevent this digital trail of breadcrumbs from accumulating every time you move information? Turns out it's difficult. And as a result, we rely on middlemen, intermediaries, to perform a whole bunch of important roles in business and society. And these intermediaries would be well known to many of you, banks, but also governments and big technology firms. And these intermediaries perform essential roles. They establish the identity of parties in a transaction. They create trust. They perform what's called the business logic, the clearing and the settling, and they keep records that can be validated by the counterparties in the transaction, by auditors, regulators, and other stakeholders. And they do an okay job, but they have some very serious limitations. The first is that they're all centralized. Anything centralized is vulnerable to hacking or to attack or to failure. This happens in the financial service industry as well as other industries. They slow things down. The settlement times for all sorts of transactions can last into the days or the weeks. To send money overseas from one country to another can take 5 to 7 days. They're also costly. To make that same transaction can sometimes cost 8 to 10%. Another big issue is that they exclude big parts of the population. There are 2.5 billion people in the world who don't have access to any form of financial services. They're part of the world's unbanked who don't really benefit at all from globalization and internationalism because they're trapped and they're not upwardly mobile. They capture data about us, which prevents us from using it to organize our affairs, but also could potentially undermine our privacy. So you can argue in sum that intermediaries capture an asymmetric benefit from the digital age, and banks are certainly no exception. So what if the internet was entering a second era, from an internet of information to an internet of value? Well, right around the same time that Lehman Brothers went bankrupt, November of 2008, an anonymous person or group of persons named Satoshi Nakamoto outlined a new thing called the Bitcoin protocol, a way for people to make to do transactions and move money peer-to-peer online without an intermediary to establish trust. And the interesting thing about Bitcoin was that it worked. And it worked so well that it's...
I'm gonna pause him real quick so that we can just digest a little bit of what he just said. Okay, so firstly, I wanna point out that that man said several times, create trust. Okay, trust
And that's what I wanted you to talk about with the definition of credit and how trust is that key word.
Yes. And another key word that alludes to trust is intermediary. Okay. Regulation. Trust has a double meaning in life. Okay. And in finance, it alludes to the true meaning. When we say I trust you, okay, versus I am creating a trust. Now, to create a trust, I was watching a movie called Jupiter Ascending, and there was a futuristic character. He was from another planet, and he said, there's no such thing as trust. He said, it's only mutual benefit or mutual interest, mutual self-interest, to be exact, is what he said. There's no such thing as trust. It's only mutual self-interest. So in the kind of, you see what I'm saying? The conceptualization of that, it makes you think, okay, if a government is here to create trust, how are they doing that? They're supposed to be regulating, right? They're supposed to be transparent. Right. That's the type of entity that you would trust. They're supposed to disclose things. They're supposed to be fair. They're supposed to be equitable. One thing that this man left out about the reason why the government is not an ideal intermediary is the number one thing that we're all seeing every day, which is corruption. They have a self-interest that is not mutual with the people. He just said there's an asymmetric benefit, meaning they're getting more of the benefit than we are. So where's the trust? Where is the mutual benefit? So the reason why he's, I think the whole point of his talk is that blockchain is eating up Wall Street. And the reason why I have a huge smile on my face while he's talking is because it is eating up Wall Street. And that's the reason why he's not going to say that. But the reason why is because if their objective is to create trust, they're doing a terrible job.
Right.
Terrible job. There is no such thing as trust when you are running away with all the benefit and the value.
Right.
The people are out here broke. They're trying to squeeze water out of a rock. We don't have it no more. We're in a national deficit in the trillions because they have not disclosed to us how to discharge the debt, how to redeem the debts for the credits. We're getting four credits. So if I go to Walmart, right, and I have a receipt for a $400 TV that I bought, and I tell Walmart, hey, I took this TV home. I plugged it up. I didn't do no damage to this TV. I took it right out the box, and this thing does not work. I have a receipt that says you owe me $400 because you did not give me what I paid for. So when I come up here with a receipt, if you don't have the cash in your register to give me $400 back, what are you going to give me? A store credit, right?
Mm-hmm. You absolutely.
A store credit. Now, if I come up there and you tell me that I have to go through all this bureaucratic rigmarole to get my $400 store credit, and now I'm just out of $400 for this huge TV that I bought is really a piece of trash. Where's the trust? Where's the value of that credit? Where's the value of that dollar, that currency? There's no value there. There's no value if the credits aren't even redeemable. I can't even get the credit. Now they got that. What if you went to the Walmart and they told you, oh, well, we have to lien a piece of your property to give you this credit, like a mortgage. Well, how much collateral do you have for this credit? What's your credit score? Even though I'm clearly evidencing to you that I have this debt that you owe me this money. I created this transaction already. I have a receipt that says you owe me this. It's already in the laws that, you know, you have to exchange this way with me. But they turn around and say, well, you got to have a credit score to get this $400 back. Terrible. No trust.
Oh, right.
No trust. Okay, you want to keep going? You want to keep listening?
Absolutely. Well,
okay.
Mm-hmm. We're 31 in. So in my mind, because remember we talked about, we're going to try to keep it like 30.
Mm-hmm.
The last one, we was like an hour or something. But I figured I didn't know if you were going to stop that up or something like that. So in my mind, we at the point, I mean, because we still want to talk about political status for sure. We definitely want to talk about why you want to be your own custodian. But I think at this point, you laid down the intro.
Mm-hmm.
You laid down the intro well, because again, we want to get into commercial compliance. Mm-hmm. We want to talk more about, and that's where we kind of started, right? Compliance, mm-hmm. negotiations, but we ain't talked about enforcement. And to me, where we at is a digestion period. Like,
yeah, you're right. Absolutely right. So I think, thank you for doing that, because first of all, you know, I could do this all day.
I know. I know. And what's so awesome about it is it comes directly from the source. So one has to be able to take the time to go back and reference it, to be able to get their own understanding. It's one thing to listen to you, it's another thing to be able to read it for yourself and then sit back and think about it, how that works in real time, and then be able to come back and listen to what you're saying, like, okay. I'm understanding what she's saying in real time because I took that second to be able to go back and research it. You know what I mean? Because at the end of the day, we don't talk about our financial disposition the way we're talking about it now. We don't talk about our political disposition the way we're talking about it right now. We don't talk about our rights in these spaces the way we're talking about it here right now. The way we talk about it in general is very generic. It's very corporate fed to us, Democrat, Republican, third party, you know what I'm saying? Like, but it's funny because we're talking about three parties as well. Trust, things of that nature as well, but how that truly relates to our everyday lives, our mortgages, our bank statements, the contracts that we're entering into, car payments, student loans, all of these things, you know what I mean? So at this point, especially after the TED talk, because definitely want to be able to go back in this episode of the podcast and listen to that, right?
Oh yes.
So we don't want to get too far away. Mm-hmm. Say it again.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, because whoever is listening, as they listen, I think when we get to our next episode and we pick up where we left off, it will be beautiful for them to go ahead in between episodes to listen to what he is saying, because he's going to elaborate pretty deeply into that topic about why the blockchain and the cryptocurrency is eliminating the need for a Wall Street system, for a securities system, because the trust is already built in when you can securely transfer data without leaving the trail behind. So it's a very interesting concept to dig into and to understand it fundamentally, so that when we are conceiving where we are still now, because we're still trapped in the security system. We have not fully transferred over to a stabilized system of encrypted currency. It's not stable yet. You know, we're still developing and stabilizing it. So once it does become stable, because you see, there are countries all over the world who are getting into the cryptocurrency now, especially smaller nations where they have plenty of people who are masters of the technology mentally. So it's nothing for them to jump onto the train of let us engineer our own cryptocurrency product, because a currency is literally just a product. It's just a product of exchange. And that means it literally and figuratively. It's just a product of exchange. So when we are, you know, seeing smaller nations getting onto the train, first of all, our people, Afro-natured, Afro-Americans, or, you know, the indigenous people in this land, we have to take note of that. That we are a smaller nation that needs to go ahead and jump on the train of nationalizing and centralizing among ourselves how we exchange our intellectual properties, how we exchange our things of value, how we exchange our real property. We need to start making sure we are jumping on that train, because the United States, first of all, is foreign to us. A British colonist who came to but we are foreign to them, and we
But you're right. I'm sorry, say that one more time. I cut you off. Please finish that.
No, I was just saying that we are foreign to them, so we have to take note. Yeah, we're foreign to the United States, the British colonists who settled here to create their commercial jurisdiction. So with the example that's being set around the world, and this is the point that I want to make, is that around the world, they're setting an example for what we also should be doing, which is recognizing our national product is our exchange and currency. Okay, so when we exchange things of value between each other, that is the thing that we need to capture inside of this system of encrypted exchange. We must capture our ability to agree and trade back and forth between each other, because that's all a currency is. So once we catch on to that and we see that all these South African nations are doing it, you have the, you know, people in India, BRICS, they're coming up with their own thing. And so for us to be a smaller nation of people, you know, we have to understand that us being the people of value that we are without a system of trade and exchange that is secured, it puts us at a deep disadvantage. So hopefully the brains in our community will come together and put together this thing so that we can come under one roof and to exchange on our own centralized digital currency.
Well, that's what we're going to talk about on the next episode. I mean, that's when we're really getting into commercial bank compliance, negotiations, enforcement. Yeah. You know what I mean? So, you know, because now we know what we can do, we got to get into the how we can get it done, right? That's how those small nations. The listeners, I hope the listeners between this episode and next episode definitely take the time to go look up nations like Israel, go look up nations like the Shinnecock that are in upstate New York. Y'all can't be quiet. No.
Okay, like I got as soon as they came down the steps, baby. You better get a chance.
That's what we're gonna get into on the next one. Definitely appreciate you as usual educating us and getting it squared away on this. I mean, this is a big thing here, y'all saying. If we're going to be the change, then we need to overstand, not just understand, but overstand how to do that within the frameworks. You know what I'm saying? So definitely appreciate all the energy and time you put into this, what Serve Inc. does. And we just go ahead and on the next go round and just keep digging into this.
Absolutely. We're going to pick it up. All right. Well, you guys, thank you for tuning in. And thank you, Mr. Smith, for being here with Serve Inc. and doing the important work that you do, contributing to our efforts to create a population of informed consumers. That is one thing that my personal goal is for my people and also any nation that comes to this territory where our ancestors put in a huge amount of investment and sweat equity into the development of this nation, where people can come here, not be lied to, not be deceived, not be taken advantage of, even though we're the ones who are being taken advantage of the most. But my goal is for us to become informed about the system that we helped to create, and so that we're not sort of being subject to the ignorance that was imposed on us. I don't want to say that our people are ignorant just because we are ignorant. We have never been prone to ignorance until we met up with colonization and this whole settling type of situation that we have been facing for the last few hundred years. So again, thank you for tuning in, you guys. We will be back. And again, we will pick up where we left off. So make sure you tune in. Peace.
Peace.